I want to thank Peter Barry and the committee of INSCART, the Council of INSCART, for trusting me with this invitation to talk with you. And I want to, if I may, pay a compliment to them for the steady, persistent work which they have now done over many years in opening up a forum for discussion about issues that I think are of enormous importance. We are grateful for the work that you and Lewis and Robert and others do in making the whole deal work for us. This is an interesting book with which I continue to ambivalate. And as we move through, I will try and indicate to you, ladies and gentlemen, what it is that causes me to stretch my thinking. I've tried to indicate to you at the start what I understand to be the core ideas that Nancy Murphy seeks to communicate in this small and densely written volume. The first is unambiguous. Human beings do not have a soul. I tried to put together some of her thoughts and we'll maybe come to those as I'll quote them as we come further along. Her notion basically is that the soul is a Greek concept which intruded itself into the biblical account and fits there badly and oughtn't to be taken too much notice of on that account. She traces, as we will see as we go along, the historic and biblical ideas of the soul and is able to point out again and again that each one that she looks at has a high level of internal inconsistency within it and has a very poor grasp onto things that we now know about human beings. And therefore she would prefer that we didn't use this nasty notion in modern discussions. Furthermore, she says that modern science makes the most current notions of the soul untenable, and we'll explore that as we go along, because this is a key part of Murphy's argument. Her recourse is to a view of humanity which she describes as physicalist. And because I've not seen that description anywhere else, I wonder if it's a Nancy Murphy term, although I suspect it actually isn't. It's the term you use when you don't want to use material. The natural term that people would have used in this context is that she has a material view of humanity, and a view of humanity which says that it can be totally described in terms of the matter of the physical bodies of which we are made. And she says explicitly that she avoids the term materialist because it's got other sort of connotations with it of greed and avarice and those kind of things, and she doesn't want to get confused with that. So she's gone with the term physicalist. But with that exception, that awkward word means what you and I in other contexts would ordinarily mean by a material or, if you like, mechanical view. Well, mechanico-chemical, that kind of view of human nature. She is a declared physicalist, as we will see, and she says that physicalism has as its danger, and she's honest enough to acknowledge this, that physicalism has as its danger an easy path to reductionism, an easy path to all there is what you can get out of atoms and molecules, and that it will be valueless and all of those kinds of things. Therefore, she has evolved, and we will try towards the end of the night to touch on this, what she describes as a non-reductionist physicalism. And the question I was wanting to ask is, when you have ultimately got yourself to the non-reductionist physicalism, have you got a set of ideas that is actually any different to the modified notion of soul, that or soul with the modifications that we would need to make to it in the light of the problems that she raises? So that's where Professor Murphy is going. Just a little bit of background. I've shown you the book. It's Cambridge. There's the ISBN, and you can get copies of it later. It's a little book, and it was published in 2006. A little bit about her as a person. I rather like to know something about people who are writing for me. She is a professor of philosophical theology. This is an American institution, and the term professor is used a little differently there to the way in which we use it in Australia. She may be the equivalent of a senior lecturer or something of that kind in the current, in the ways in which we would rate people here in Australia. But nonetheless, she has an established lecturing position in Fuller Theological Seminary. Fuller is at the theological right end of theological institutions within the United States. It is a conservative organization with a strong Bible base. A close personal friend of mine, who some of you might have known, namely Frank Anderson, Francis Anderson, Old Testament scholar, was for many years a lecturer on the biblical staff of Fuller. And while I was away on holidays, in pure deference to research for this paper, I had to visit Melbourne and go and spend a couple of nights playing 500 with Frank, just so that I could find out about Nancy Murphy. Well, she is indeed a member of that, and he is a very much conservative biblical scholar, and is very much representative of the standpoint of Fuller, where he taught for many years. Nancy Murphy is on the speaking circuit about Christianity and science around the town. You raised the question, Peter, as to whether she might actually have been here at the first ISCAST, the first COSAC conference at Moore College. And I was never able to get any further with that. But does anybody know whether Professor Murphy was here at that conference?
No, she was in one of the
Adelaide courses. Thanks. That clarifies it. I didn't think that I personally met her, but she is very much on the speaking circuit. She writes very widely on theology. She co-authors books with Bob Russell, who was, in fact, the keynote speaker of that excellent conference at Moore College some years ago. He was a very thoughtful and engaging guy, and the fact that he and Nancy Murphy published together, in my view, accords her a degree of credibility. Because some of the things she says are going to be somewhat surprising, I want to quote to you something which she actually wrote incidentally. I often think things that people write about themselves incidentally to a text are more valuable than the things that are part of the advertising blurb, which you'll see a bit more in a moment. She writes this: why do I care about writing this book? She's actually talking about the physicalism of the mechanism of doing an intellectual task like writing a book. She says, why do I write about this book and doing it well? Part of the answer is that I recognised some years ago that I had a call from God to use my philosophical education for the sake of the church. So whether she has a soul or not, she has that sort of stuff. And I think it's important to recognize that, and to recognize that, like a lot of us, I have the sense that her talk is somewhat tougher than the person that you see at the back end of it. Who is the book addressed to? I think it's useful to have this in mind, because I hope very much to encourage you by the end of the night to think that this is a book worth getting and reading. I've been enormously educated by doing so. It's written to theological students and young graduates. Because of its arise in Fuller, it's addressed to another student population of Fuller, that of Christian teachers and church professionals. A lot of them are taught through Fuller and go back to being their work as counsellors or youth leaders or social workers in among the underprivileged in cities, but go there having had a firm theological education and grounding from an excellent institution. It's written in a series called Current Issues in Theology, and they are described as focused studies on key issues in theology, and certainly the status of the way we are to look at humanity would be a key issue, and one that we ought to prize highly in terms of our own discussion and so forth. I hate the yanks. It is then described as state of the art. So what you're hearing is the state of the art of play in the area of the position of the soul in theological thought. Well, I'll leave that to you. I would never be brave. I want to just offer a little bit of personal disclosure, and I hope you'll forgive me for doing this. The first is to tell you that I am very old. I make that comment because I make that comment because I am increasingly conscious, as I talk with young people around our church environment, as I talk with my children, that the younger generation think differently in some very fundamental ways to the ways in which we did. I'm not in here to say whether that's better or worse, only to say that it's different, and I want you to understand that if I bring a perspective to this, mine is the perspective of a guy born in the 30s and essentially trained in the 50s and 60s in terms of thought. I'm proud, almost humbly proud, to say that my initial degree was in physics, and my initial professional work was in physics with CSIRO at Sydney, and that I deserted that to go and get myself a real, that is, theological education. And it was out of that that ultimately I came to with Stuart Babbage's fault. Those of you who know him can beat him up satisfactorily for this, but he asked me to get involved in the teaching program in the new pastoral care course in Ridley College, and a year of doing that and of careful thought and being the sort of hard-nosed science person that I had sadly become, I found myself thinking medicine is the only way into this. And I won't go back to that if you want to know more of that, but that's where I came from. I've been doing medicine now for about 30 years, and I suppose, and I've had a lot of Christian patients from a variety of different from every denomination in the area where I worked. I'm delighted in the Lord to say, and therefore I've had my mind exercised very continually about what it is about the humanity of the person that I'm working with that guides and shapes the way I think and the way I manage, and in the case of many of them, what it is about the Christian faith and spiritual aliveness of this person that guides and thinks the way I should approach this this question. So to me, in a way, there's a certain non-academicity about this that made me very willing to grab at the chance when Peter asked me would I bring some thought to Nancy's book. I will try and let you understand where my where I sense that my prejudices are lying when they surface, but that's so you can discount for cash. Let's go to the book. Enough of the preliminaries. It's a book written in four chapters, and they are fairly clear. The first is to sketch the history of the soul in the broad history of our culture, in the theological history, and last, and in a sense a little bit least, I think, in a biblical sense, but we'll come to that as we come to it. The second is to talk about those are not right. And something has gone amiss there, so let me give you those correctly, and I apologise for that. The second is about the impact of science, and I'll give you the headings correctly. I don't quite know how that slipped in there. Chapter one is, Do Christians Need Souls? Theological and Biblical Perspectives on Human Nature. The second chapter is, What Does Science Say About Human Nature? That is, what are the impacts of physics, evolutionary biology, and neuroscience? The third chapter is, Did My Neurons Make Me Do It? Reductionism, mortality, and the problem of free will. And I can see now what's actually happened, and all that's actually happened is that they've got one out of order. So that the list is actually correct, with the exception that this one belongs at number two. So I'm sorry for that that diversion, but that threw me just a little bit when it suddenly wasn't happening the way I thought it would be. Okay. I have listed to you at the beginning the issues that Murphy seeks to arrive at in the end of the day. As is so often a point in these discussions, there is an underlying large philosophical question which keeps lurking and raising its head. It is a very live physical, philosophical question in the current philosophy of science debate, even apart from the Christian component of it. And it is about how we are to view human beings. And there are three major possibilities, and they're quite simple. The first is what I would call the WYSIWYG view. What you see is what you get. It is the view that there is only one component to, if you like, one way of looking at a human being as a complete unity and whole. And that view is called monism. And I will hope to demonstrate by the end of the night that monism, in a practical sense, has a great deal going for it. Now, I'm not saying it's the right view. What I'm saying is that my experience is that Christians, in general, are apt to underestimate the power, strength, and importance of a single, whole, integrated, one-stop-shop view of human beings. By far, the regnant view around the traps, both in Christian theology and in philosophy at the moment, is number two, the dualist view. simply put, the dualist view says we have a physical body, and then resident within that physical body is, and here's where the thing gets a little bit tricky, resident within that physical body is a mind or soul, and that depends a bit on where you're having the debate and who you're having it with. So those two are separate components interacting with one another and working together. This is called dualism, and it is, as I've said, still the popular view, and certainly among Christian circles, it and this dreadful name, the third one, trichotism, hold sway in about equal numbers on Murphy's research. That is, if you talk around the Christian shops about how we should see human beings, Christians will generally say either they're a body and soul combination, or they're a body, soul and spirit combination. That's particularly the evangelicals and or the charismatics and some others who want to stress the difference that comes to people when they arrive at faith in Christ. And they end up with a three-part humanity called trichotism. Underlying much else of what we see is that kind of analysis. We will come back again and again to say, where does this thing fit on that scale? What Murphy does in chapter one then is to look at ancient philosophies broadly. She then takes a look at Plato, at Aristotle, at the Christian fathers, of which I am abysmally ignorant, and my ignorance was made more profound, I've got to say, when I visited Melbourne. This is an aside, and I promise not to have them, because Frank Anderson has not only a whole shelf lined with the writings of the fathers, we'd had that when I was there 3 or 4 years ago, but the sod's read most of it in the time that since I was there last time. It's very depressing. It's very depressing indeed. So I'm not by any means an expert on the fathers. I'm not an expert on any of this. Don't let me pretend. But we'll look at Thomas Aquinas as having some particular things to say, partly because he's very influential. We'll have a look at the reformers. And then least but not last, we'll have a look at the Bible. I'm being a little bit naughty, but this is one of my concerns. There you see the naked beginnings of dualism, and it goes certainly back to Plato, and actually goes a long way back further than that. A human being, says Plato, is an immortal soul. That's interesting. The ancient Hebrews may not have had too much about immortality and life after death, but Plato certainly did. And you just think, oh, well, that's good. A nice, here we've got a nice, simple dualist. Well, yes and no. The trouble is that for Plato, the soul is itself a three-tiered entity. Why, you ask? Well, the answer is because the obsessing concern of, and we'll come back to this proposition again and again, that the obsessing concern of Plato's people was that objects were only in part material, and you could classify objects according to how much of matter was in their constituency. When he came to confront the situation of the soul, it seemed that there were matter components in it, but the only way he could really deal with it was to say, well, we'll have a layer of the soul which is very mattery, we'll have a next layer in which matter plays a smaller role, and we'll have a top level in which matter plays little or any role. I don't propose to go any further than that, largely for the good reason that I couldn't anyway, but because it was just thrown in to indicate that from the moment you start to work with this, everybody who's worked at it has had problems of one kind and another. Then there was his student Aristotle. Now Aristotle, like a good lad, talks about a soul as well. The only interesting thing about Aristotle's view is that the soul for Aristotle isn't actually a thing. The soul is not an entity, but a kind of principle. Now you start stretching your head and saying, what's a principle? How does that differ from a thing? And we'll come into more of that in a little while, because that kind of distinction about there being material things with properties and non-material things, principal things with properties, starts to enter the discussion with Aristotle. It reflects the view of Aristotle's time. Things are a blend of matter, which was extremely crude and simple stuff. All matter was constituted of, earth, air, fire and water. Well, you all knew that, but that's where that all fits into that. And form, which is, again, you see this kind of pervading principle giving things their real character. I've got to tell you that notion of form has embedded itself deeply into language and still runs down into English language. Sometimes when we use the word form, we end up using it in a sense that is totally Aristotelian, and totally in the way in which Aristotle would have done it. And some of the cognates and derivatives of form. So Aristotle is now getting into this kind of situation. Now what you see is that all the good bit is in the form. There's not much in the matter, because you haven't got anything to play with, you see. There's not much in the matter. All the good stuff, all the really meaningful stuff, I love that word, is actually in the form. Let's keep going. The fathers, the church owes a great debt to the great thinkers of the second and third centuries AD. They wrote extensively and very thoughtfully about the Christianity of their time, and we could well profit, in my judgment, from resurrecting some of the things that they wrote, which are even judged by modern Christian standards insightful and helpful. I've listed a few that had significant views of the soul. Origen certainly did, Jerome did, and Augustine did, and we'll come to him in a bit more detail. All three of those very much based on Aristotle. Interestingly, Tertullian, who's also important, looked more to Plato's model to found his notions of humanity and the soul on, but nonetheless I've listed these for a very simple reason, which isn't on the screen, and that is that all of their models of the soul were different. Little or no congruence in any of them. They all felt it was very important to describe, if you like, the way God saw the humans that they were talking about, but this is so often the case, they ended up with fairly divergent and different descriptions. I thought that we might then turn to that great character of the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, because the truth is that the four spiritual laws, the stuff that evangelists pick up to trot out as things that people need to believe in coming to faith in Christ, are not the Creed of St. Athanasius. They're pretty well straight from Thomas Aquinas. The notions of sin, the notions of repentance, sure, they're biblical notions, but the actual formulation of those things is actually out of Thomas Aquinas. So Aquinas is meeting what for him is the modern world, and he starts to say, well, I've got to have a notion of the soul that I can trade with in developing a more complex doctrine. So he says he gets a soul which ends up with a hierarchy of capacities. He has a group of capacities, for example, which are called vegetative. They include growth and reproduction and temperature control and all sorts of some of these basic things. Those things, he says, we have in concert, wait for it, with animals, and they are things that we share with, in part, with animal soul. St. Thomas said it, not me. I found this kind of thing surprising and interesting to go with. They're called the vegetative capacities. Then we have higher capacities at levels than that. The thing about the capacities that he then identifies are that many of them are capacities which we would now call clearly activities of mind. They had to do with learning, they had to do with making moral judgment, they had to do with behaving and disciplining oneself to behave correctly and so forth. And he saw all of those things as stemming out of the activities of the soul. And a point that Nancy Murphy will make in strident detail as she goes forward is that one of the problems with classical models of the soul is that that nobody would argue these days that many of those are not clearly the province of neurochemical mind, and that they are now understood in terms of research into the way people behave and the way they think and the way they do things. Now we'll come back to that issue again as we get a little bit further along, but that's Thomas Aquinas. I left the reformers because they're boring. Basically, they don't get into the issue of the soul except, would you believe, for one issue, and that is what happens to the soul after we die, between then and something else happens. And they get into it because there is a regnant doctrine around about that, namely the doctrine of purgatory. And that's a problem to them, because purgatory, you remember, is in a sense an essential piece of theology. So you've got to have good theology to get anything done in the world, and this supports the theology behind forgiveness and those dreadful indulgences of which we speak so brutally. I just make the comment that, of course, that whole system works because you've got people in a sort of suspended state where if people pay up and do the right thing, some good can be done for them. I don't think anybody thinks like that in the modern world, and if you happen to be a Catholic, some of my best friends are Catholics, I'm not having a shot at the Catholics, I'm just making a comment that there was once a time when many people in the church kind of thought, did think like that. So the reformers had some thought about where the soul was and how it should be dealt with, but didn't add much to our descriptions of it. So we come now to the Bible, and I've got to say that if you look at my poured over copy, you will see that this area is very heavily poured over and finger marked, because I read it with considerable care. I wanted to be sure that I actually understood her message, and also that I did justice to where she is. She tackles it by looking separately at the Old Testament and the New Testament, though the end results are somewhat similar. She points out, starts with the Old Testament to say that there is little in the Old Testament about life after death, and I don't think anybody would dispute that. I must admit, only because it was rolled at me as an exam question many years ago, I do just temper this by reminding you that probably the oldest book on literary grounds in the Old Testament is probably the Book of Job. And it is in that wonderful book that you get the following text, obviously thrown at students to comment on. Job saying, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." Now, I don't know what you make of all of that, and I'm not here to I'm not here to tease you about that issue, but and it does stand in some isolation. The general point is well made, but it's an interesting little it's an interesting little side swipe on the question of life after death. In the I wanted to pay Barry a compliment, and I will see that he gets it. I thought Barry Newman's paper, looking at the word in the Old Testament which is translated soul, when it isn't being translated as something else, and we'll come back to that in a minute, the word nephesh has a wide spectrum of meanings, is certainly nothing to, not stretching the point at all. And for those of you who were here at the paper and saw that very careful stuff that Barry did, like a lot of words in the Bible, it can mean a wide spectrum of things. Idiot of the week story, but you might like that. I hope nobody's offended, but I heard, again, I learned a lot from my trip to Melbourne, but I heard that a group of scholars in the United States at the extreme right who said that a word in the Bible has only one meaning ever, once you found it. And the way you find the meaning of the word is you find the first occurrence of the word in the Bible, and you work out what the word must mean in that first occurrence, and it means that same thing every time that you meet it thereafter. I haven't actually been able to find anybody who isn't wearing a thing I see that actually believes that. But it's interesting the things that you hear from time to time and the propositions that people pursue. Her point, though, is then that even among the things that are translated soul, you get a variety of different fits and meanings. If we go down to the bottom, she lists some meanings of soul from the words from the Psalms. The first list that she gives are, and I meant to have them up there and I don't, I'm sorry, but they're a list in which the meaning of soul is clearly that bit of the human being which transcends death, which responds to God, which goes to be with God. The classical stuff that Christians would think of the soul as being. And she says, well, they're there, but then she goes to list a group of others, of which Psalm 7, 1 to 2 is a case. Psalm 7, 1 to 2, I think, is the one that talks about the sword dividing my soul. And you think, oh, okay, not dividing it from my body, but just cutting my soul in half. And you say, well, wait a minute, that's different. It's clear that the word soul was used in a variety of different ways, and there's not any single way that will satisfy that. So let's just take that on board for the moment. Professor Murphy says that, and I quote current scholars, affirm the view that the Old Testament's view of humanity is more physicalist than otherwise. Now, the problem I have with that is that I wasn't able to find in her book any evidence of that. That may not be because it isn't true, though I've nothing, I've got no evidence to support it. But it may just be that because she's writing a synoptic book, she needs in the end to quote agreed results of research, but one of my tasks as a pursuit of this is to try and pursue the literature further and see if there is concordance among theological writers and thinkers around the notion that mechanicalist, fleshy view of humanity is the one which they come down on the side of. The truth is that she finds the Old Testament unsatisfactory, and in that she's in accord with the way she writes the New Testament, unfortunately. And for a set of reasons, they're not all that dissimilar. She starts by saying that the New Testament is written in Greek. Well, I do like propositions that start on firm foundations, and you certainly can't argue with that. It's the next one that's a bit different. Therefore, it is influenced by Greek thought. Well, in some restricted sense, that has to be. You can't take up a language without picking up the ideas and the thought forms which that language enshrines. And so, on the gentle end of that, that's fine. Furthermore, she says there are contradictory notions of the soul in the New Testament. I've got a couple of friends here, three of them on my right, who sat with a group of others that we sit with regularly last Friday night while we had a look at the things that they thought about the soul, and we looked at some of the things that you find skimming through the New Testament about the soul. And there are a variety of different pictures used at different times and with at least different emphases. She says, therefore, what she concludes in the end is that the New Testament doesn't have a view of humanity. At least it doesn't have a view of humanity in terms of this question. It has many other good things to say about humanity, but it doesn't settle the question of how unified a view you should take of the New Testament. I think that that would be a very useful for members of ISCAST at the sort of theological edge of ISCAST. I think it would be a very interesting thing to take up and hammer through and see what a wider scan of literature and a more careful look at the Bible's use of soul actually had to say about that. But I accept there is diversity, and again the recourse, Murphy's recourse, is to modern scholars who then point to a physicalist view of humanity. And she does name one or two of the post-war theologians, not Oscar Kuhlmann, but Kuhn is certainly loved, and Rudolf Bultmann is listed among those. I did a little bit of work on Bultmann in my far-off theological study days, because I was taught by a guy who was a Bultmanniac. Sorry, he'd been taught by Bultmann. I don't recall that issue coming out of that, and perhaps anyway there are other issues of concern in the end about where Bultmann's theology got to. But the names were thrown around without too much to get to, so I think that there's room for more work to do that in saying that modern scholars have a physicalist view of humanity. I had only one comment to make about this, and if I may be permitted, just a personal comment about it. I would have thought that the very fact that there was some significant diversity in the New Testament uses of psuche, translated soul, was very much against the notion that some well-formulated Greek notion had been brought in and was the import of the word. It makes no sense to me to try and run those two things simultaneously. I think that, like a lot of these things, there are a raft of these words, that in Greek thought it was a pretty smudgy idea, and that when somebody has wanted to say something, they've used the word picking up on one of the meanings of the word which fitted the context well at that time. That's not nice stuff for biblical expositors to have to deal with, but it is the reality of the way the world is, and people who want to teach the Bible and understand its meaning well have got to come to grips with. Is that right, Lewis? Am I doing? Yeah, okay. He's been there more recently than I have. That's all. I'd have to come to grips with that sort of stuff. I'm not totally convinced that the Bible has an unassailed physicalist view, nor am I convinced that it's essentially unreadable on the point, though I do think that more work needs to be done. How are you coping? You all ready to go to sleep yet? Can we... Okay, well, yes, what I think we might do, and it would suit me if I can spend a few minutes just talking about the impact of science, and I think some of the other issues then ought to be left to another time, because there's a fair bit to it. And thank you for your honest comment. I value that. I wish people would say that rather than sitting there and thinking it. Okay. This lady sees the critical forward moves in our thinking in relation to science as revolving around three cardinal phases, and they are those. Let me go to the first one, because it's the least obvious one, I think, as it was to me. The Greeks pondered about the nature of stuff, and they were divided around a very simple question. And the question was whether stuff was infinitely divisible, or whether it could be reduced to a point where you could cut it no more. That is, to a set of fundamental things called atoms. The Greek tom bit is to do with the Greek word to cut. And the A in front is the negating thing, the so-called alpha privative, which says you can't do it. So an atom is something which you cannot cut. And in Plato and Aristotle and all of these guys well on, the atomists had a bad day. They had a lot of bad days. They were very much on the notion that matter was a combination of substance, as we said before, earth, air, fire and water, and form, which was something of an influence imposed on it, but which was non-material, but which gave it its character. And I commented earlier that notion persists very strongly. When Dalton and those around him demonstrated conclusively that the matter was made up of not of four fundamental elements, but of 90 odd, suddenly the opportunity for diversity simply by rearranging the bricks became enormously enhanced. And this old hylomorphism was rapidly displaced by atomism. Murphy has a passage which I won't stop to read, but you can have a look at it afterwards, saying that putting the earth at the center of the earth, of the sorry, putting the sun at the center of the universe, did something more important than to prick man's pride a little bit. Everybody notes that since we went geocentric, men didn't like that because they were no longer at the center of the earth, of the universe. But she says it's bigger than that, and she's actually able to sustain an argument which I won't try to reproduce, which says that because of the theories of motion and of attraction of things to one another, the old atomist process is actually lethally wounded by that move. I wouldn't have known that. I pass it on to you for what it's worth. But it is, as I said, a dense argument around theories of motion. So the move into atomism means that models which are form operating on substance, and many of the old models of the soul were indeed that, now have a much more questionable validity. You now can't go that way with those, because that's not the way form and character and so forth is conveyed. It's actually conveyed by building the form out of the so-called individual building blocks. So I meant to make one other thing, comment about atomism. Of course, it's like everything else we teach in science, it's wrong. It was just good to make the point that atoms are as divisible as all get out, but it's a nice teaching point when you're trying to get some second year chemistry student to actually believe that we understand how the world works. I just say that to keep our pride in place. And that was the impact, the philosophical impact then of the resurgence of atomism was that. Darwinism is connected in a way that I think you would expect, which is that it forges at all sorts of levels a much more intimate connection between us and our form and structure and that of the animals. Now, it goes well beyond the question of whether we could possibly have evolved from them or not. That's another argument which we can have, but we can put aside in this regard. The fact is that once you start doing comparative biology, the strength of structural and functional congruence is enough to make you think, hey, there's something funny going on here. We're exactly like them, except we have a soul and they don't. Doesn't prove anything, but it became in the debate and the discussion an important talking point around the survival of soul concepts. It would have gone all right for a while if we'd stayed with Thomas Aquinas, who was happy to have an animal soul, but unfortunately the church deserted Thomas not long after Thomas deserted the church, and the difficulty is that no modern thinkers are as happy with an animal soul as he might have been, and so there's a chance to get out of the problem that way is lost. I just make the point at the end from Murphy that modern genetics strengthens and adds detail to our connection with the animals. I have a personal view that modern genetics strengthens the fundamental tenets of evolution as well, though I, as I've said here before, think that the I don't want to say creation scientists, so who do I want to say? The people that we talked about, the intelligent design mob, thank you very much, it's terribly old. The intelligent design mob have very serious material which is to be listened to carefully. There's more to it than just evolution. So you can see that at that level the soul's getting a bit of a rocky passage, and there's a little snippet in here about social Darwinism which I won't take time over, except that that was to make our connection with the animal kingdom even more palatable because of the nature-ridden tooth and claw stuff, which she lay fairly firmly at the doors of two Anglican clergymen, namely Mr. Malthus and Mr. Paley. And they were fairly tough guys, and both of them of great eminence, and both of them quite happy to have a socially aggressive human organisation as well. There was a lovely quote there from Malthus saying that a bit of aggression and a bit of rough stuff breeds character and promotes industry and gets good things happening. Oh, just mentioned it in passing. The last segment that she talks about of the modern scientific development, and I think the one that we need to take most seriously and that presses me most in my work, is the modern human science, and particularly modern neuroscience. She says, and I went the trouble of quoting her because I think she's just goes that bit too far all the time. She says, all of the human capacities once attributed to soul are now being fruitfully studied as processes involving the brain. Well, I've conceded before that many of them are, and it's a question of what, it kind of begs the question a little bit, because I don't see a lot of good research yet, though I think it'll come, studying what happens when I pray or when I communicate with God or even when I read my Bible that isn't just understood in the ordinary frameworks. And that really underscores the kind of reservation that I have. Modern accounts are incoherent and therefore, she says, the only treatment of the soul that she's prepared to talk about is the one which we talked about from Aquinas. And again, she says a little dismissively, because all the Christian accounts of the soul after that are just hopeless and unreadable and you can't make any sense of them. Well, it might be right. She's read a lot more than I have, but that sort of negative is just a little hard to take on board. So she says, she suspects, and this is where she's coming from, that all the other capacities once attributed to the soul will also turn out to be products of complex organisations rather than properties of a non-material entity. She proceeds then to a lengthy discussion about consciousness and self-reflection. Consciousness is the great Achilles heel for the neuroscientists. Mind you, it's been an Achilles heel for everybody else too, but nonetheless it remains there to keep the neuroscientists vaguely humble, because they really don't have that I'm aware of any kind of model. They have models for self-reflection, but not of the kind and the depth that human consciousness ultimately gets to. I have made a comment of my own that the model that it is true that we are now seeing brain regional localizations of some higher mind functions. I remember being terrified, and this was back in the 60s when I discovered in Melbourne that they had only then started to think about giving up doing frontal leucotomies. Do you remember that thing? Severing fibers in the frontal lobes for people who were deeply depressed. And I've got to say, it worked. And they were there at pains to tell me that it worked. But one, and I hope you'll forgive me for this frank illustration, but the psychiatrist he was talking about, he said, it gets a bit distressing though when the person whom you've treated, having had a nice afternoon with you, wanders over and urinates in the ashtray. And it was that sort of disinhibition which leaves you wondering whether you've quite solved the problem. Old metaphor from Leon Morris about throwing out babies with bathwater, and there's a sort of that theme has gone through my mind a whole lot. And certainly she points to the temporal lobes as defining areas that are associated with the appreciation of emotion. And as our imaging science and so forth gets better, we're going to see a lot more of that stuff. So don't hold your breath in thinking that you're going to have too many hiding places for some elements of human functioning that we've regarded as sacred. I suppose one of the things that worries me about the view that she's putting is that I don't want to get caught in the end in the soul of the gaps any more than I've been caught in the God of the gaps, and it's the same issue. The soul is there to do only those things that we don't yet know how they work otherwise. That would not, I think, be a good place to be. So physicalism, she says, is the only tenable current model, but, and here's where I love Murphy and where she gets me, being the gorgeously open woman that she is, she says, but you've got to have my kind of physicalism, and it's a non-reductionist physicalism in which there is still room for God's spirit to act and to work on you and to do good things. Well, I could probably live with that kind of physicalism, but as I said at the beginning, I'm not sure whether that's a whole lot different to what we started with in the start. I think that's enough for tonight. Thank you for listening so carefully. Thank you.